In the first hour of Issues Etc. today, we're going to take a little trip to the other side of the globe, literally, to Australia. We have two guests here in Studio A who have joined us before, Charles and Babette Francis. We're going to be talking with them about Christianity and culture in Australia. Find out whether or not Australia is, in at least in a rough sense, and this is my sense of it, but maybe I'm wrong, culturally, socially, religiously, a parallel to our culture here in the United States. We'll talk about the problems that we share, and we'll focus a bit on feminism in Australia, especially its incursions into the church on issues such as the ordination of women, abortion, and other issues. In the second hour of the program, we'll be talking with Pastor Henry Gehrke. He will also join us here in Studio A. A hymn study for the season of Lent, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, will be the hymn and the subject of our study in the second hour of Issues Etc. The third hour is open lines for your questions and your comments. You may have been watching the papers and the news in general, following with intent interest the capture, the arrest, and the interrogation of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, said to be either two or three in the Al-Qaeda organization. His picture has been splashed all over the media. Apparently, he is singing like a bird. The intelligence community, in particular the FBI and the CIA, are saying that they are getting more information from him than they've probably gotten from everybody combined in the past, and significant information. They say what once was a trickle of information regarding Al-Qaeda and its plans is now a waterfall, a flood of information, and most of it apparently is coming from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Here's the question I have for you. I was reading on beliefnet.com, Elliot Abrams, I believe it was, or it could have been Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. The stories appeared under both names on beliefnet.com, arguing for the torture of terrorists like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, if information can be extracted that will prevent future terrorist activity. This particular writer says it is a torture's evil, but it's an evil that needs to be engaged to if we can prevent terrorism in the future. I want to know what you think about that. Is terrorism a justification for torture in the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? That's your question for the third hour of Issues Etc. Open lines for your questions and your comments. If you have a question or comment on Christianity and culture in Australia, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Monday, March the 17th. Charles and Babette Francis are our guests here on Issues Etc. today, joining me here in Studio A. Charles is a former member of the Victoria State Parliament. He's currently a trial lawyer and guest lecturer at Melbourne University, and Babette is the national and overseas coordinator of a pro-life and pro-family organization called Endeavor Forum. Charles and Babette, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
Babette, I want to begin with you and see whether my sense is correct that Australia, culturally, socially, morally, and religiously, is a rough parallel to the culture, the social, the moral situation here in the United States.
It's a rough parallel, but there are differences. You fortunately have a much higher going percentage of your people attending church at least once a week. I think your percentage is somewhere between 40 and 60%. In Australia, it's below 20%. So that's, you know, we're a far more secular society. On the other hand, our crime rate, I believe, is substantially lower than yours. So in that way, we're doing a bit better.
A bit of irony there.
It is a bit of irony.
Charles, the same question to you. Is there a parallel between the United States and Australia?
Yes, there is a close parallel. I'd make this comment. I think there is more good in the United States, and there's also more evil in the United States. Some of the evils in the United States are very evil. On the other hand, there are some magnificent Christians in this country who are giving great moral leadership. Australia falls short of your level there. On the other hand, we haven't got quite the evils that you've got here.
We're kind of a more laid-back society, so it's neither as good nor as bad.
So what I'm sensing here is that Australia and America seem to be kind of on a rough parallel track, although America seems to exercise the extremes than Australia does as a culture.
But you also have a profound influence on our culture because of, the close political ties between our countries, the common language, and the influence of American television. We get a lot of American television, so you do have a profound influence on our culture.
That's not necessarily a good thing. Charles, the state of the law in particular, if we could just touch upon abortion a bit, what is the current state of the law regarding abortion in Australia?
It varies from state to state. There are three states now in which it's completely legal. In three other states, though, in general terms, and this is an oversimplification, the abortion may only be performed to preserve the woman's life from a serious danger to her life or health. In fact, of course, the abortionists operate where there's no justification at all and nobody inquires into what they're doing, so the situation really finishes up very much the same as it is in the United States. Fortunately, we have had very little third trimester abortion in Australia, but otherwise the position is virtually identical.
Is there anything akin to the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in Australia?
No, there isn't. But as I've explained to you, we've come very close to a Roe v. Wade situation in practical terms.
So, Babette, when you look at, in particular, the issue of abortion, not only from the Australian perspective, do you see the pro-life community in the United States as an ally to the pro-life community in Australia?
Very much so. It's ironical, although you have the Roe v. Wade decision here, or perhaps because of it, your pro-life movement is much more active and much more successful in winding down the incidence of abortion than our pro-life movement is in Australia. Because it's theoretically illegal in our major states, the pro-life movement has not been as successful in Australia. And I think our percentage of abortions, percentage-wise, on a population basis, is possibly higher. We have 105,000 abortions a year for a population of 20 million people, and yours is about a million for 280 million people. If you've got the maths in your head, you can figure that out. But your pro-life movement has been very successful here in a lot of legislation which modifies Roe v. Wade, you know, like parental consent laws and waiting periods and so on. We haven't gone for that because abortion is still theoretically illegal in our major states, so we can't really go for that. You know, it's not good enough to say that if your mother gives you permission for an abortion, it's okay because the law is saying it's not, you know, so we've sort of hung on to that. And the big advantage in Australia is our politicians and feminists can't get up and say, women have a constitutional right to abortion, therefore you can't, you know, outlaw whatever. They can't say that in Australia. There's no constitutional right to abortion.
Charles, has there been any push for a constitutional right, an amendment, a court decision to say across Australia, roughly to what happened in 1973 here in the United States, what was illegal in some states will now be, by fiat, declared legal?
There hasn't been what I would term a federal push because abortion falls within state law, but there have been pushes within the individual states. For example, in 2001, abortion was made completely legal in all circumstances in the state of Tasmania. The same thing happened in Western Australia a little longer ago, and it also happened in South Australia. But the three major states are still in the position which I described, in which theoretically the abortion can only be performed to save the woman's life from a serious danger or a serious danger to her health.
I don't think there could be a Roe v. Wade decision in Australia because I don't think we've got anything in our constitution comparable to the right to privacy. I don't think there's anything in the Australian Constitution which guarantees a right to privacy on which, in the penumbra of which, your Supreme Court justices found some imaginary right to abortion.
The key term there is penumbra, and the key term there is that I mean, I would argue that there was no right to privacy in the Constitution before they invented it in 1973.
Right. Well, I would agree with you about that. But in Australia, we have no Bill of Rights within our Constitution. And this, I think there's considerable advantage in that.
That's odd, really, from a perspective of the United States, because we consider the Bill of Rights so precious. But it sounds as though you're saying it may also be an Achilles heel with regard to courts that would like to legislate things like abortion from the bed.
Oh, absolutely, because we believe that rights come from, fundamental human rights come from the Creator, and no national government can legislate on what is your right. You know, really what they're doing is taking away rights from you. And an example of this is, let's say, the right to ordinate, women's ordination within a church. When our government brought in the Federal Sex Discrimination Act, they very kindly, in quotes, exempted the churches or the Catholic Church from this. And we said, that's all wrong. They have no right to grant an exemption, because if you grant an exemption, you can take it away. It implies that you can take that right away. So we said, the church has nothing to do with the government. The government has no right to say anything about ordination in the churches.
Now, that raises a very important question. And that has to do with the relationship between church and state in Australia, in particular what the mindset is down there, if I can say down there. I know you think of it the other way around. But in Australia, Charles, how would you characterize the relationship between church and state? It's a very contentious issue here.
It's a little different from the situation here. The state and the church in Australia have a complete separation. On the other hand, we don't have a situation as you have here where they may forbid prayers in schools or something of that nature. Certainly individual bodies try to stop it, but in general terms we've been able to keep some religious education in the schools. It's optional, and we also have some prayers, and we also have some Christmas celebrations.
The more important thing is that our church schools get government aid. They get federal government aid and state government aid. You know, a certain percentage of what the government schools get, they get this aid quite openly. So there isn't this kind of phobia that, you know, you're infringing on religious freedom or religious rights if you are involved with a particular church.
As you may know, there is under our president administration, under George W. Bush, he has something called the faith-based initiatives, in which they are allowing certain federal monies to go to faith-based organizations that do community service. And people have expressed kind of that phobia that if we are taking federal money, the state's money, we will in some way have to pay the piper when the time comes.
There is a danger in that because the Catholic schools in Australia, well, all the church schools, they get what we call state aid. That's money from the government. But with that comes a requirement that they conform in some ways. Now, we don't mind them conforming on health regulations or the construction of toilet blocks or something like that. But when they say you've also got to look at anti-discrimination legislation and equal opportunity legislation, then the church may be in some difficulty. And, of course, the church bureaucracy gets influenced and infiltrated by the federal bureaucracy in education and the teacher unions. So that becomes a real danger. We think that the money, instead of going to the church education system, should go directly to parents in the form of vouchers or per capita funding for the student. It should be based on the student, not on the church, and let the parents use that money for whatever school of their choice. We think that's the best system, where the church doesn't get tangled up in conforming to government requirements.
And as it's a two-way street, as the road goes the other way, well, how would you typify, and I'll ask you both this question, Charles first, how would you typify the church's influence in the culture in Australia? You mentioned a low church attendance, and the church's ability to influence the state.
It used to have considerable influence, but unfortunately it's lost most of that influence in the last 30 years.
For example, the churches fought very hard to stop our federal government from passing legislation on the extraction of stem cells from human embryos. We succeeded, and all the pro-life groups as well, we succeeded in having a ban on human cloning, both reproductive and so-called therapeutic cloning. but we failed on the embryos. The licensed agencies are allowed to extract stem cells from human embryos, which of course kills the embryo, for a certain period of time for embryos created, surplus embryos created for IVF post April of some year.
So it sounds as though on the issue of human cloning and stem cell research, Australia is quite a number of steps ahead of where the United States is legislatively, a ban on human cloning.
Yes, and we are ahead of that.
Yes, that's very unfortunate, but that is the case in Australia.
No, well, it's fortunate because the ban on human cloning is America.
I'm talking about the embryo experimentation.
Now, let me get this straight then. There is a total ban on all human cloning in Australia.
Yes.
However, IVF embryos, that is in vitro fertilization embryos, the so-called surplus embryos, are a subject of stem cell extraction.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
There's limitations on it. There are restrictions on it. But embryos created up to April of either last year or this year can be used for some experimentation for extracting their stem cells, but only through licensed institutions.
It was also indicated that they would not permit the creation of further embryos for the purpose of experimentation, but no doubt there will be pressure in the future. They may say, well, we've had a certain amount of success, we need more embryos, and then there will be pressure on the government to widen it.
The churches and the pro-life movement have enough influence on both state and federal governments that neither state nor federal want to really touch the issue of abortion. They don't want to push for a Roe v. Wade type decision. You know, they all want the politicians just want to leave it where it is.
What is the mindset of the Australian public on the issue of the three that we've discussed up to this point? First, abortion, then human cloning, and then stem cell research. What's the mindset of the public, Babette?
On abortion, I think it would probably be similar to the United States. They think it should be there for the so-called hard cases, you know, and possibly in the first trimester. I don't think they like it at all for second trimester, or certainly not for third trimester. I haven't heard of, there was one case of a third trimester abortion in a hospital where a woman came in and her baby was diagnosed with a dwarfism, that it would be a dwarf. And she had an abortion, and in fact, they injected potassium chloride into the heart of the baby. And there was a big furor about that. The public didn't like it, and the hospital staff were in trouble and so on. So that's the only one I've heard of a sort of close to third trimester abortion.
And I assume this was performed in one of the states in Australia where abortion was...
is illegal, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
There has been some trimester abortion in the state of Queensland, but it hasn't led to a prosecution. And the doctor who did that, I'm sorry to tell you, came down to Melbourne and lectured at Monash University on how to perform trimester abortions. But so far as I'm aware, none have been performed in our state or New South Wales.
Are there, in America, in virtually every state in the union, there are abortion clinics. There are facilities set up pretty much for the sole purpose of a woman obtaining an abortion. Are there abortion clinics in Australia?
Yes, there are. There are. There are a certain number that are performed in the public hospitals, that's the government hospitals, and there are also specific abortion clinics.
All right. Let's turn to the issue of feminism and its influence, not only in the culture, but also within the church as well. And I think the place to begin there probably has to do with the issue of women's ordination. You're both Roman Catholics. Mm-hmm. And I would like to get your thoughts on that. Is there any move afoot across denominational barriers in Australia for the ordination of women? Have there been churches that are indigenous to Australia that have ordained women to the priesthood or to the pastorate?
Yes, there have been. The Catholic Church has been very firm on this, that there is going to be no ordination of women now or ever. On the other hand, the Anglican Church, which is the equivalent of your Episcopalian Church, has caved in, and they've ordained women for the last few years. There's now a growing controversy about, can these women be bishops, ordained as bishops? The Uniting Church also ordains women. In fact, it's a very feminist-oriented church. The Continuing Presbyterians, which is a conservative church, they used to ordain women but no longer do so. So that's a good move in the other direction.
If I could ask just from my personal perspective, because I am a Lutheran, what about the Lutherans in Australia?
I don't know very much about them. I was speaking to one of your staff earlier, and he said there was pressure on the Lutheran church, but I don't know about the internal pressures on the church. I do know that they have a good pro-life movement. You know, the Lutherans for Life is active in South Australia and in Victoria.
I wanted to add this, that in the Anglican Church, there was a long and bitter debate about the ordination of women. Those in support of the ordination of women finally won, but that drove quite a lot of people out of the Anglican Church, and some of them came into the Catholic Church because of that.
How powerful, Babette, how powerful is the feminist movement in Australia?
It's powerful. It's not as powerful as the feminist movement in the United States, and I think its power is waning. What's very interesting in Gallup polls is that young women don't want to identify with feminism. You know, even the ones who are career-oriented say, I'm not a feminist. It's got an ugly image in Australia, and they don't want to identify with it. On the other hand, the feminists, from being protesters and demonstrators in the 70s, have now infiltrated the bureaucracy. They're in the public service, and that makes them very dangerous because they can implement their agenda without the public even being sort of aware of what they're implementing. I don't know whether you've looked at our website, but it starts off with that we are founded to oppose feminism, Endeavor Forum, and we start off by saying feminism is an evolutionary anachronism. It's a Darwinian blind alley.
You mentioned before the strong influence of the American media in Australia. Is that also a source of feminist influence in Australia?
Yes, our feminists have learned from your feminists. You know, Betty Friedan's book, The Feminist Mystique, had a big influence there. On the other hand, we've exported to both the US and the UK, Germaine Greer, who wrote The Female Eunuch. So it's been both ways. But yes, the legislative initiatives of your feminists, they have a strong influence on Australia because our feminists want to imitate that. The feminists in Australia don't have an original idea in their heads. They want to imitate what American feminists are doing.
So they are parroting what they are hearing, the bright lights of feminism in America.
Absolutely.
What about your work in the United Nations? You have been on the forefront trying to fight the influence of feminism within that international organization. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I started off in 1980 at the Mid-Decade for Women conference in Copenhagen. That's where Judy Carter, who was the daughter-in-law, I think, of President Carter, signed the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women on behalf of the United States.
CEDAW.
Now, you all have never ratified it, fortunately. Our government signed it, and we ratified it about 3 or 4 years later when we had a Labour government. We fought very strenuously against that.
What's wrong with it?
A lot of things, because it starts off with the assumption that there are no differences between men and women and that they've got to be treated identically. And that's absurd because we don't want women in combat roles. We don't want abortion to be treated like medical procedures on men. Those are two of the sort of glaring things. But the other thing that we dislike about it is in Article 5 it says, government should take all steps to modify the social and cultural patterns of conduct of men and women. And it goes on to eliminate, discrimination and so on. But how can you give a government the authority to modify your social and cultural patterns? You know, culture must come from the people, not from the government.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Charles and Babette Francis. Charles is a former member of the Victoria State Parliament. He's currently a trial lawyer and guest lecturer at Melbourne University. Babette is the national and overseas coordinator of a pro-life and pro-family organization called Endeavor Forum. If you have a question or comment about Christianity and culture in Australia, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A few other things we'll get to in the course of this conversation. We'll be talking a little bit about the issue of homosexuality in Australia. We'll also be talking about an area of Charles's expertise having to do with the abortion, breast cancer link, and the religious makeup in Australia. Stay with us.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, etc.
When should a Christian confess his sins to another Christian? When should a Christian confess his sins to his pastor? When, if ever, should a Christian confess his sins to the whole congregation? You'll find answers to these questions and more in the new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's called Confession and Forgiveness by Ted Kober. You can order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. You can also order the book online by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book, and you can even read an excerpt. Issuesetc.org. Now, when you call, be sure to ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, Confession and Forgiveness, 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute remembers a great missionary, Patrick, the person we remember on St. Patrick's Day. Legend is that Patrick drove snakes out of Ireland, but what's true is that he shared the good news of Jesus Christ across cultures. Remember to pray for a missionary you know that their work will have a positive, lasting impact for eternity. And pray for Ireland. About 4 million people live in the country, with 1 million people living in the capital city of Dublin. Ireland is a young country, according to the Missions Handbook Operation World. Half the population is younger than age 28, and spiritual needs are evident by a high rate of suicide. However, the youth are also responsive to the gospel, and there's an openness to publicly presenting the gospel in Dublin using street dramas. Pray for Ireland and for citizens there to have a profound relationship with Christ. Learn how to pray for countries and people around the world by logging on to the website missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. St. Patrick's Day, party time! Here's the real story. Born in England in the 4th century, young Patrick was kidnapped by pirates and sold into slavery in Ireland. He escaped, studied theology, and returned to Ireland as a missionary. Tradition says Patrick established 300 churches and baptized 120,000. That's not unlike Joseph in the Hebrew Bible. He too was sold into slavery in a foreign land, and he too did good to his brothers who had wronged him. It was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you, Genesis 45:5. And that's not unlike Jesus, who, Philippians chapter 2 tells us, being in very nature God, made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant. He humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. God's good comes into the world that way, through suffering, not through our parties, through serving and not being served. Jesus, we pray, remind me to bear the cross for others. Remember, you can hear my minutes on demand at KFUO.org, and by going to my website, daleamyer.com, you can also subscribe to the email text of the minute. Thanks for listening.
Don't think that work of baptism is anything man does. It's purely the work of God. To believe that God works through the means of grace is to trust in Jesus as Savior. And that trust is a trust in His promises. As He Himself says, how do we make disciples? Listen, by baptizing, by teaching.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss with Scott Klusendorf of Stand to Reason a recent column on human cloning by Ellen Goodman. Also, Ted Kober, author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March called Confession and Forgiveness, will join us to talk about confession of sin as a profession of faith. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. Now, if you have a question or a comment on Christianity and culture in Australia, you can give us a call right now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our guests are Charles and Babette Francis. Charles is a former member of the Victoria State Parliament in Australia. He's currently a trial lawyer and guest lecturer at Melbourne University. Babette is the national and overseas coordinator of a pro-life and pro-family organization called Endeavor Forum. If you're interested in visiting their website, here it is, the website for Endeavor Forum, endeavorforum.org. It's all one word, endeavorforum.org. .au? You want to add that at the end. .au, otherwise it won't get where it's going. So it's Endeavor Forum. Is it .au or .org?
.org.au.
Okay, endeavorforum.org.au. That's Endeavor Forum's website. Before the break, we were talking about CEDAW, the UN, to put it simply, a UN treaty that would impose all sorts of feminist agenda items on every signer of this treaty. You mentioned before the break, Babette, that the United States, in the person of Jimmy Carter, has signed the treaty, but it has never been ratified here in the United States. Should the United States ratify CEDAW?
No, of course not, because as I understand it, it's much more serious for you to ratify a treaty, because once it's ratified by your Senate, it then supersedes your domestic law. Whereas in Australia, our ratification of the treaty means that we have to pass specific legislation to implement some of the treaty, and we've only implemented a bit of it, and there's a lot of debate about the legislation, so the Parliament has a chance to consider it. But in your case, if your Senate ratified it, I don't think your Congress could debate any bills on it. It becomes automatically the law of the land.
That's one of the concerns that we have here. Charles, what is the Australian mindset regarding the United Nations, in particular with treaties like this, CEDAW, and other treaties that would impose kind of the social and moral requirements on signers?
I think, unfortunately, in general terms, there's been a lack of interest in these treaties. But with when the treaties have come up for consideration, signing, and ratification, there has been some strong debate within the Australian community. For example, back in 1989, we signed the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but a number of us lobbied and spoke in public places and published articles pointing out the flaws in the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but nevertheless the government signed it. More recently, we signed and ratified the Rome Statute, which provides for the International Criminal Court. Once again, there was a very strong debate on that. The Australian lawyers, or some of the best lawyers, international lawyers, spoke out strongly against assigning that treaty. But the attitude of the Attorney General and the Foreign Minister was that they were going to sign it regardless. And they didn't make any intelligent answer to our arguments. They preferred just to deride the people who put forward arguments. One of the people who put forward an excellent argument, and he spoke to a number of our politicians, and he wrote a memorandum of advice, was Professor Richard Wilkins from the Brigham Young University in the United States. But they just took no notice of what he had to say, and unfortunately we have signed that treaty.
And what were your objections to the Rome
Statute?
Treaty? Yes, the Rome Statute.
Part of it is very good, you know, insofar as it deals with war crimes. But the real problem is this, that the jurisdiction is defined so widely that activist judges could say almost any course of conduct fell within the ambit of the statute. Now, if they'd wanted it to be confined to war crimes, they could quite simply have drawn it in that form. The fact that it's been drawn in such wide and undefined terms made many of us extremely suspicious. We took the view that the people who were promoting the court, or some of them, also had the idea that the court would be used for social engineering at a future time. If I could give you one quick example, there are people in Europe who hope that they will be able to prosecute the Pope for vilification of a segment of the community if he says that homosexuality is a sin.
So in other words, even the Pope himself wouldn't be exempt, at least in the minds of some, from that kind of world court.
That's right.
All right. Have some thoughts on feminism. We were talking about feminism earlier, but feminism in the law in Australia, what has been the agenda there? You were talking about kind of an equal access judiciary.
That's right. In Australia, we have about 1,500 trial lawyers, and of those, about 150 are women. Some of those women are very skilled and competent and certainly hold their own with the best of the men. On the other hand, there is another group amongst those 125 who are demanding that they get all sorts of privileges, demanding that equal number of men and women be appointed judges. And insofar as that has been implemented, it's been a disaster. Women judges have been appointed who have had no qualification for their post, and they've really given the feminine the women lawyers a very bad name.
There's another aspect to this, that the feminist agenda in the law looks at group rights rather than at individual rights, and this can result in a lot of injustice. For example, we had a case in Melbourne where a university professor was alleged to have touched the breast of a student he was dancing with at a formal function. Now, he denied the charge, and another an honest feminist, wrote a book called The First Stone, in which he said he was probably innocent, you know, put his side of the case. Well, other feminists argued he may be innocent, but other men have done this, and he should be made to pay. So, you see, they don't realize the innocence or the rights of the individual. They say group rights. Because other men have behaved badly, this guy must pay.
Is there anything, one of the contested issues here in the United States is affirmative action, not so much with regard to its racial component, but with regard to women, whether or not there ought to be affirmative action for women in the workplace. Is there something comparable to that in Australia first, you, Charles?
There has been some moves for affirmative action within the workplace, a demand that with all promotions, equal number of women be appointed with men. Well, of course, if you've got 1,000 men and 100 women, if you're going to have equal promotion to the top positions, that is going to operate very unfairly, and men of far greater merit will be passed over.
We fought that very strongly because we felt that affirmative action, which involved any kind of numerical or quota system, was unfair on the same basis of individual rights. And while our Labour government, previous Labour government, tried to have what we call hard affirmative action in quotas, the present government, which is supposed to be conservative and is more conservative than the Labour government, it's looking at affirmative action more from the point of view of access, not so much numbers, as that there should not be unreasonable requirements for a job. In other words, you shouldn't say that radio broadcasters all have to be 6 feet tall, you know, because it's not related to the job, and that would exclude a lot of women. So they're looking more at equal access, which we don't oppose, but not equal numbers. So the present government has softened that a lot, and it's largely because of it's a great deal because of the way we fought it, you know. Endeavour Forum fought it very vigorously and pointed out the injustice to men who were trying to support wives and families. The main wage earner for the vast majority of families with children is still the man. You know, the wife may have a job, but he's generally the main and the higher wage earner. So anything that discriminates against him or makes it harder for him to have a job, it discriminates against his wife and his family as well.
You mentioned something during the break, Charles, that that many women in Australia do not want the these kind of quotas or these items on the feminist agenda.
Yes, that's right. The ones who are well qualified in their particular field, they don't want these quotas. And they feel that it detracts from their position, because a woman may have got to where she is on merit, but people will say of her, she only got there because she was a woman, which is untrue in her particular case.
Moving from feminism to the issue of homosexuality, there has been one state here in the United States of the 50 that has made legal something they're calling same-sex unions. They are avoiding the term marriage, although there are several other states who are currently considering the possibility of attaching the term marriage to same-sex unions and making these legal. In Australia, is there anything comparable to this?
There is a push in that direction. There's been one recent case which indirectly has an impact on this. The Family Law Court recognized as marriage a ceremony between a woman and a man who, no, how was it?
Between
a man and another man, and the first man had had a sex change. He'd had an operation, so he was now listed as a woman.
Transsexual.
Transsexual. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the family court recognized this, and we understand the federal attorney general is going to appeal against that decision. This is sort of indirectly on the same-sex thing, but so far the government has resisted moves to say that same-sex unions will have the status of marriage. There is a demand by homosexuals to say that when one partner dies, the other partner doesn't automatically inherit, or workers' compensation doesn't go to the surviving partner, and so on. But I think those things could be overcome by establishing some kind of legal partnership or business partnership or something like that. Marriage in our constitution, I think, is defined as the union of one man and one woman.
There is a constitutional definition in the Australian constitution for marriage?
Now, marriage is not defined in the constitution. I think, so far as I know, it's not defined anywhere, but it's...
I think in the Marriage Law Act, it is defined as the Family Law Act is defined as the union of one man and one woman, and the states handed over their legislation on marriage to the federal government, so it comes under the Federal Family Law Act.
Charles, is there a link in Australia, as there is in the United States, between the feminist agenda and the activist homosexual agenda?
Yes, the two do tend to run together. To give you one example, I have found that homosexuals ordinarily very strongly support abortion rights, but there are clearly links between the two.
It seems strange because homosexuals normally don't have children or not with their same-sex partner, mm-hmm. So it seems odd that they should lobby for abortion rights, and especially as they're also very keen to adopt children. I don't know where they think these children are coming from if they're going to, you know, promote abortion. But I think the underlying philosophical reason why there's a union between homosexuals and the feminist movement is that both subscribe to the theory that there are no differences between the sexes, and it doesn't matter who you have sexual relationships with. In fact, the ideal feminist said her utopia would be achieved when you didn't know and didn't care about the sex of the person you were marrying.
Hmm. It's an interesting world envisioned there. With regard to, you mentioned adoption, can homosexuals legally adopt children in Australia?
I don't think they can. I think there again, adoption comes under states' laws, mm-hmm. and I don't think they can at the moment, but there's a strong demand for that
not
to
so
be.
Not so far.
Not so far.
What about in the church? There have been several mainline Protestant denominations in the United States that are currently taking up the issue of, it's kind of a trifold issue, the ordination of active homosexuals, the blessings of same-sex unions, whether or not they're recognized by the state or not, and the whole kind of general issue of homosexuality within the life of the church. Is there a similar move within Christian churches in Australia?
Yes, there is a similar move, but the benchmark, the line is being held by the Catholic Church, which says the physical expression of homosexuality is sinful. And so, you know, it's out there. It says that some people have a homosexual orientation, but provided they lead chaste lives, you know, they're not to be blamed. But the physical expression of homosexuality is a sin.
Are there denominations that do bless same-sex unions or
yes.
do ordain homosexuals?
Yes. There has been a number of ordinations of homosexuals in the various Protestant denominations, and also, I think, in the Anglican Church.
It's mainly in the Uniting Church, which is very liberal in Australia. The Uniting Church is a church composed of a union of the former Congregational, Methodist, and Presbyterian churches. They united to form the Uniting Church, and then a group of conservative Presbyterian churches remained outside as
the continuing
Presbyterians.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to, we have talked about cloning and abortion and stem cell research. One that we failed to mention there was the issue of euthanasia. We have a regular guest here on Issues, Etc., named Wesley J. Smith, who often joins us, but he has made mention several times of some experiences he has had in Australia, in particular with the issue of euthanasia. Where does that particular issue stand? Charles, we'll begin with you. Where does that issue stand in Australia, euthanasia?
In Australia, euthanasia is not legal in any state. About 4 or 5 years ago, the territory of the Northern Territory did introduce and pass euthanasia legislation, but because it was a territory, the federal government was able to control its legislation and a bill was introduced to overthrow that bill in the Northern Territory, and it was successful, so that there is no state or territory in Australia where euthanasia is legal. But there's constant pressure by the supporters of euthanasia to try to have it legalised.
And we have this famous euthanasia campaigner, Dr. Philip Nitschke, running all around the country and making statements that become sound more and more eccentric as time goes on. He's had some devastating cases. There was one woman, Nancy Crick, whom he encouraged to kill herself, and she believed she was suffering, or it was claimed she was suffering from incurable bowel cancer and was in great pain and so on. After her death, an autopsy was performed, and she wasn't suffering from any form of cancer or any terminal illness. So it was just...
How is Nitschke viewed? Wesley Smith has called him the Australian Dr. Jack Kevorkian, our Dr. Death.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an accurate description.
Is that how he's viewed by the public as well down there?
Well, most of the public down there don't know a great deal about Dr. Kevorkian, mm-hmm. but the reaction of the general public to him is fairly similar to the American reaction to Kevorkian.
Was it Nitschke as well who attempted at least to sell abroad some form of a suicide machine or a suicide bag?
He's always coming up with suicide kits, you know. He's mm-hmm. trying to develop some pill that people can take. Mm-hmm. He's also come out with something called the exit bag, which is a plastic bag with a velvet-lined collar so it won't chafe mm-hmm. your neck, that you, once you put it on, you tighten it and, you know, you can...
Hey, Charles, are these things legal? These things would be illegal in Australia,
wouldn't they? To sell them to somebody would be illegal.
Even the importation, I think they were seized at customs when some arrived from Canada.
And so if I could summarize, in Australia, euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide is illegal in every case.
Yes,
that's right.
Is
it still performed?
Probably is, but... people, it's not publicized.
It's performed in what I'd call the hard cases, where a doctor comes in and he has a patient who is in, let's say, great pain from cancer or whatever, and he may increase the dose of morphine, which would hasten death. You know, that would be one of the ways in which physician-assisted euthanasia would be performed.
Well, some might argue that if he increases the dose of morphine within a reasonable, he is simply engaging in palliative
care. That's all right, but I mean, I think some probably would increase it to cause fairly immediate death.
Now, in our country, one state has legalized physician-assisted suicide, the state of Oregon on the East Coast, and our current Attorney General has attempted through the Drug Enforcement Administration to make doctors accountable for their use of certain restricted drugs in this process.
I really congratulate John Ashcroft. I think that was a splendid initiative. It was probably all your federal government could do to override Oregon's law, and I commend him for...
Are there similar laws in place, Charles, in Australia, that if there were a state to legalize physician-assisted suicide, parallel in Australia could take a similar
We haven't got legislation of that nature, but if a doctor assisted suicide, he could certainly be charged with manslaughter. That would be the way I think we would go in Australia. He'd be charged under the criminal code of the state in which he lived.
The way our federal government defeated the Northern Territory legislation was by overriding the state's legislation passing federal law, because the Northern Territory is like your Washington, D.C. It's not an independent state, it's a federal territory. So the federal government was able to override that. I don't think the federal government would be able to override, would find it as easy to override a state which passed euthanasia legislation, but fortunately so far no state has.
I'm fairly confident that in fact constitutionally it couldn't override state legislation.
And that actually, in light of our earlier conversation, that's actually probably good news with issues like abortion if the states want to keep abortion illegal. Am I correct?
If they want to keep it illegal, the federal government can't override that, nor could our High Court, which is the equivalent of your Supreme Court.
We have only a few minutes left. I did want to touch upon the case in that you had a hand in, Charles, with regard to the link between abortion and breast cancer. Tell us about that.
Yes, I had a woman who came to me, and she had severe psychiatric reaction as a result of an abortion. But because I knew of the information from Professor Brind, when she told me her details, I immediately identified her as falling in the relatively high risk of having of getting breast cancer as a result of the abortion. I sought an opinion from Dr. Brind, and he confirmed that, and we then sued on her behalf on the psychiatric basis and also on the failure to warn of the breast cancer link.
And what was the result of that suit?
In Australia, in Victoria and most other states, before you go to trial, you have to have a mediation. At the mediation, the plaintiff's trial lawyer states what his case is and refers to the main items of evidence. Then the defendants tell what their case is. They try to point out the defects in the case of the plaintiff. Equally, the plaintiff points to the defects in the defendant's case. The mediator, to some extent, plays the part of a judge, but the essence of his function is mediating. He suggests to the defendant, well, now look, you ought to make a financial offer in this case because these are your risks. He also will point out to the plaintiff its weaknesses. In the end of that mediation, we were offered a quite substantial amount of money. It was clear that the defendants didn't want to go on with the case. They didn't want to have it fought out in court. And my client decided that she wanted to accept the money. So that case was settled. We believe it's the first case of its kind in the world. Interestingly, not very long after that, another lawyer had started a similar case, and I was invited to lead the legal team in that case also, and that case was also settled.
Last question, with only about a minute here, Babette. The link between abortion and breast cancer is one that has been contested of late here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Are there any doubts in your mind about that link?
No, absolutely not, because it has both a statistical basis and the evidence is statistically based, and also there's a biological explanation for it. Most breast cancers are caused by cumulative exposure to estrogen, and in a pregnancy, the level of estrogen rises about 2,000-fold compared to the non-pregnant state. Mm-hmm. And this stimulates the breast cells to multiply and proliferate. And these cells don't reach maturity and stabilize as milk-producing cells until the last few weeks of a full-term pregnancy. So if you cut the pregnancy short with an induced abortion, the breast cells are left in this unstable multiplying state. And when cells are dividing, that's when they're most prone to something going wrong, a mutation, something going wrong in the DNA and leading to cancer.
Babette, thank you very much for being our guest. Charles as well, thank you for being our guest. Charles and Babette Francis.
Well, thank you very much for inviting us.
Thank you.
Always happy to have you. Anytime you're back in the States, come right in here and we'll have another conversation. Charles and Babette Francis have been our guests. We've been talking about Christianity and culture, the broad spectrum here in Australia. Charles is a former member of the Victoria State Parliament. He's currently a trial lawyer and guest lecturer at Melbourne University. And Babette is the national and overseas coordinator of a pro-life and pro-family organization called Endeavor Forum. Their website address, again, for those who are interested in visiting, endeavorforum.org.au. endeavorforum.org.au. When we come back from this break, we're going to turn our attention to the hymn, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. Pastor Henry Garrity will join us here in Studio A for an Issues Etc. hymn study. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.